It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, the last year and a half has seen some big changes in the healthcare market at the state and national levels. We'll look at where healthcare and insurance stand in Wisconsin today. First, it's our weekly review of national politics. House Speaker Paul Ryan said today he's not going to seek re-election in the November midterms. Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg is spending a lot of time talking to Congress, and the FBI raided the home and office of President Trump's personal lawyer. That's a lot. You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. What do you think of Paul Ryan's announcement? Do you think we'll see his name in politics again after 2018? And what do you think of Mark Zuckerberg's testimony to Congress yesterday and today? What do you think should happen in the wake of Facebook user information being leaked? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@wpr.org. Amanda Turkel is with us. She's the Washington Bureau Chief for the Huffington Post. Amanda, welcome back to Central Time.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, let's start with House Speaker Paul Ryan saying he's not running again. Here he is at a press conference yesterday.
You realize something when you take this job. It's a big job with a lot riding on you, and you feel it. But you also know that this is a job that does not last forever. You realize that you hold the office for just a small part of our history, so you better make the most of it. It's fleeting. And that inspires you to do big things. And on that score, I think we have achieved a heck of a lot.
House Speaker Paul Ryan speaking this morning, not yesterday, as I said just a moment ago for some reason. Amanda, there's been speculation about this happening for months now, right?
Yes, we first reported that there was speculation about him resigning in mid-December. So this has been a long time coming, although we didn't know it was going to happen today.
And he had denied, and his office had denied, rumors that he was going to resign. I was looking back. Technically, he's not resigning. He's not running for re-election. So those denials over the last bunch of months were technically, I guess, true.
Yeah, right. Exactly. They were technically true. And, you know, maybe Paul Ryan was still trying to figure out if he was going to run for re-election. I mean, he said he thought about just resigning, not retiring at the end of his term, just resigning, but decided he couldn't do it to his party. So, you know, there's a good chance that Paul Ryan has been trying to figure out exactly how he would make his exit over the past few months.
Let's look at House leadership now. Among the Republicans, there have already been rumors, and not just rumors, people talking about, hey, yeah, if this gig opened up, I might be interested. Who are we looking at as possible successors as the Republican leader in the House, whether that's as House Speaker after these elections or as House Minority Leader if things don't go so well for them?
Well, the most likely people are Kevin McCarthy, who is the second ranking Republican in the House, and Steve Scalise, who's number three. Kevin McCarthy, he is sort of an affable guy. He had been talked about earlier, but he doesn't quite have the vision necessarily that Paul Ryan has. I mean, Paul Ryan came in very reluctantly as Speaker. He didn't really want the job. I mean, everyone knew him as this policy guy who basically sort of wanted to go after the welfare state. But people liked him. He was good at fundraising, and he was someone who seemed palatable to everyone. He had conservative policy ideas, but the mainstream Republicans liked him as well. Kevin McCarthy... He's well-liked within the party, but he doesn't come in with this policy vision that Paul Ryan had. Steve Scalise has gotten a lot of attention because he survived the shooting at the congressional baseball practice. And he, again, also well-liked. But Steve Scalise, honestly, has had some problems of his own. He was considered for, a bigger position in the party, but he's acknowledged that in 2002, while he was state representative in Louisiana, he spoke at a gathering hosted by white supremacist leaders. And that was a really big deal back in 2014 when this came out. And he had to distance himself from former KKK leader David Duke. And, you know, now with Trump at the head of the party, is this the person they want as their speaker, sort of going down? Again, Scalise is a very different guy than Donald Trump. He's much more liked in the party. But, you know, this is something that's going to be coming up again if Scalise does ascend to higher power.
Looking at Paul Ryan's legacy as House Speaker, a couple of the things he'd wanted to do for a long time, tax reform. He did that. They passed a big tax package. But under the Obama presidency, he was really making the case for fiscal conservatism, bringing down the annual deficits. His resignation comes after a new estimate that we're going to be hitting trillion-dollar annual deficits pretty soon. So a mixed legacy from his goals over the last bunch of years?
Yes, very mixed. And I mean, again, he wanted to, you know, Republicans have wanted to repeal the Affordable Care Act. And now Paul Ryan will be the second speaker to resign while Republicans sort of had this as their big goal that it hasn't been achieved. So he did get tax reform passed. And like you said, that has been something that Paul Ryan has cared about for a very, very long time. But he hasn't privatized Medicare, which is something that he wanted to. He hasn't transformed programs like food stamps into smaller, more state-based initiatives. And, you know, honestly, Paul Ryan's big legacy that he's leaving on the party is that he championed these really conservative ideas on fiscal, economic policy, things like that, that he made them more mainstream because he had this sort of appealing persona. He took them out of the think tanks. He made them mainstream. And they're incredibly unpopular with the public, but incredibly popular with the Republican Party. And now they're associated with the Republican Party, which could hurt them in the midterms.
Amanda Turkel is with us from the Washington Bureau of the Huffington Post. We're looking at some of the top stories in national news. We'll talk more later in the show in our next hour about Paul Ryan's decision not to run for election again. You can hear more tomorrow on the morning show at 7 and weigh in with your thoughts as well. I want to move on to another story that could have been the top story of the week. Mark Zuckerberg, Facebook founder, CEO guy, talking to Senate committees yesterday, House committee today. Want to listen to a bit of his opening statement yesterday before the Senate Judiciary Committee and Commerce Committee.
But it's clear now that we didn't do enough to prevent these tools from being used for harm as well. And that goes for fake news, for foreign interference in elections and hate speech, as well as developers and data privacy. We didn't take a broad enough view of our responsibility, and that was a big mistake. And it was my mistake, and I'm sorry.
Amanda, was that apologetic tone something he stuck with throughout questioning by senators?
Not really. He was mostly evasive. He was very good at telling lawmakers that it's something that he would consider, that he didn't have the answer, that he would need to get back to his staff. That it was very complicated and he couldn't just answer it in one or two words. And quite honestly, a lot of times he got away with it. And it was in part because the lawmakers questioning him aren't the most tech-savvy people. And a lot of them don't understand how Facebook works. They don't understand that Facebook isn't just Facebook. It's all these other things like Instagram and Messenger and WhatsApp and just so many more things. You know, you had senators who seemed to not understand that Facebook sells ads, for example, and you know, obviously there were some questioners who were better than others, but you didn't get a lot of real answers out of Mark Zuckerberg during these hearings.
This is 42 senators, I think I read, from these committees showing up, and then the House today. There were private meetings yesterday with Zuckerberg. Why now? What is it that tipped members of Congress to say, okay, we got to talk to this Facebook guy?
I mean, it was really all of this stuff over Cambridge Analytica and this sort of panic that people's, you know, that millions of people have had their data shared without their consent and without their knowledge. And I think that, you know, Facebook in a lot of ways doesn't have any natural allies in Washington. And so you have Democrats who are increasingly skeptical of sort of monopoly power, upset with Facebook. And you have Republicans who see the tech industry as being a little too cozy with Democrats, willing to go after Facebook as well. So you have everyone willing to come in and say, we're going to grill you. We think something needs to be done. And it was just sort of the perfect storm when, you know, between all of the Trump stuff, the Russia stuff, Cambridge Analytica, and that, you know, Facebook was in the eye of everything.
I want to bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Karen is with us in Lake Geneva. Karen, hi.
Hi. Thanks for the topic. You know, I listened a little bit, but not all of it because I'm very busy, and I figured, you know, it'll shake out with the commentaries. But I've said all along, you know, these people have gone into it just for looking for quick, easy money. you know, there was a great article, I think in September of 2017 by the New York Times, of the vulgar Silicon Valley, how, you know, it's all about getting who can get rich the quickest and the youngest, and we're paying the price. And I think they should find Zuckerberg and Sandberg as much as they can and put it into school to police, because, you know, we've got a real bad police problem, too. They, you know, that just like that last shooting, they were there, but they were afraid to go in or whatever.
I want to jump in, Karen. I got a lot there already to dig into. Karen says she hopes that Facebook could be fined. We hear other people saying regulations for Facebook. Is Amanda, anyone in Congress saying, yeah, we need to introduce legislation to do something here?
Absolutely. Now, whether or not anything gets done, I'm not sure. But, you know, one thing that is being looked at, it's just that Facebook, you know, sort of came in when the tech world was just sort of more wild. And there still aren't a lot of regulations on something like this. And so the question is now, what do you do? And I think there's a lot of support amongst lawmakers for so-called affirmative consent, so that Facebook can't just share your data and then hide these privacy options so that you can opt out of some of that. Instead, the default would be that Facebook would not share your data unless you go in and you tell them that they're allowed to do it. Obviously, that's not something that Mark Zuckerberg likes, but that's something that, you know, could be forced upon him if lawmakers decide to do something, if some of these European regulations force them to do it. Another proposal that's being talked about in Congress is creating sort of something like the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, but for technology. I think that would be very hard to do, but that's another thing that's being looked at.
We heard from David, who emailed, Facebook should make moves to protect the data, which is their bread and butter. I do not think there should be a government regulation issue. And then Marshall joins us on the phone. Marshall is calling us from Menominee. Marshall, hi. Oop, there we go. Marshall, hi.
Yep, I'm here. So Facebook makes money off of people's information and what they do on the platform. Did the people in Washington get into the fact that basically the users of Facebook have consented in a lot of ways towards Facebook profiting from the connections or the things that they do? I mean, TV stations, media outlets have asked us to like things for years, and therefore any Facebook users be surprised that the company Facebook is profiting from what they do on the platform.
Marshall, thanks for the call. So, user beware. This is it's been general knowledge that, yeah, this data is going somewhere, Amanda.
I think that's what a lot of people at Facebook argue. But I think what its critics would say in response is that a lot of that isn't really clear. It's very hard to go and find that fine print. You can't really opt out of everything that Facebook shares. And it's not necessarily, you know, I think people don't realize that it doesn't just share, you know, maybe what you like, your hometown, but it tracks which websites you go on. It sort of tracks your sort of broader internet activity. And some people still say, you know, maybe I don't have a problem with that. It's fine if the advertisers target me. But, you know, again, what I think the Cambridge Analytica scandal, why that disturbed so many people, is that it wasn't just sharing what you do when you go and participate in something, but it then has access to all of your friends and what they're doing. And, you know, these people didn't give their consent. And so I think it's just, you know, I think people would like Facebook to be a little bit more transparent about what exactly it does. And then there's the question of, is it a publisher or is it a utility that needs to be regulated in a way more like the railroads, for example, or phone companies or things like that, and have more regulations?
Amanda Turkle is with us, Huffington Post Washington Bureau Chief, looking at some of the week's top national news. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Coming up, this FBI raid on Donald Trump's personal lawyer, the president hinting at firing Robert Mueller or Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein, or at least not ruling it out. Do you think the president should fire them? What should be the response if he does? What do you think of this FBI raid on Michael Cohen? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We continue our talk with Amanda Turkle, Washington Bureau Chief for the Huffington Post, looking at some of the week's biggest news out of Washington. And there's a lot. Amanda, another big story. This one broke yesterday. An FBI raid on the home, office, and apartment building of Michael Cohen, personal lawyer to President Trump and for Donald Trump for years before that. What is some of the reaction you're hearing today?
Well, people are increasingly concerned that Donald Trump is going to fire Rod Rosenstein, the deputy attorney general who oversees the Mueller investigation, or whether he's just going to fire Mueller himself. You know, Trump has told the New York Times a while back that he would consider firing Mueller if he crossed a red line. And that meant going outside the scope of the Russia investigation and looking into his finances, for example. And it seems like that this might have crossed a red line for Trump or come very close. I mean, Michael Cohen has been Trump's personal attorney for a very long time. It's clear by the tweets that Trump is upset. He accused the FBI of breaking in to Cohen's office. And so I think people in Congress are getting, on both sides of the aisle, are getting worried about what Trump may do.
There's been talk in Congress, especially from Democrats, saying, hey, we need to pass legislation protecting the role of Mueller more. Are any Republicans getting on board with that at this point?
Yes, there is actually bipartisan support for this. Senator Tom Tillis from North Carolina and Senator Lindsey Graham from South Carolina have been on board with the legislation. And today, Senator Chuck Grassley, who's chairman of the powerful Senate Judiciary Committee, says he would actually like a vote. He would be in support of a vote on legislation to limit Trump's ability to fire special counsels. So, you know, Republican criticism is still quieter than Democratic criticism, but it's there. And it's there, especially in private, that a lot of people just think that this would be a very bad idea for Trump to do it.
I want to bring on a caller. Mitch is with us in Madison. Mitch, hi.
Hey, this is Rich. I don't know if you've got Mitch or not, but this is Rich.
Oh, Rich. Yes, Rich is what I'm looking for. Rich, hi.
Hi. I don't think people are paying attention to the fact that a federal judge had to be committed, had to be convinced that there was a crime committed in order to issue that warrant. So I don't think that, I think this talk about breaking in and seizing stuff is not very accurate.
Rich, thanks a lot for the call. We talked yesterday on the show to a former U.S. attorney who talked through the process here, and this is not something that's done on a whim, it sounds like, Amanda, raiding the office of an attorney.
No, not at all. You know, like the caller said, a federal judge or had to sign off on the search warrant after finding probable cause of criminal acts. You know, it doesn't necessarily mean there was anything, but there's enough cause for that to happen. I mean, the person who signed off on this was Rod Rosenstein, who is the number two at the Justice Department. And he's essentially the number one because Jeff Sessions, the attorney general, has recused himself for anything having to do with Russia and Bob Mueller. So this is, you know, this was at the highest levels. You don't just go and raid a lawyer's office willy-nilly because of the attorney-client privilege. Like, there was a good reason to do so. So, yes, this was absolutely serious and not at all how Trump was tweeting.
Rich, thanks for the call. I want to touch on another story or two before we're out of time. Amanda, you've written about us here in Wisconsin. Senator Tammy Baldwin up for re-election this year, facing challenges and lots of money coming into this race. Can you talk about what we're seeing?
It's definitely becoming one of the top Senate races of the 2018 cycle. I mean, Tammy Baldwin has faced more outside money on the conservative side than any of her Democratic colleagues up for re-election. Actually, all of her Democratic colleagues up for re-election combined. That's how much money is going into Wisconsin. And probably a lot of your listeners have been seeing those ads on air already. A lot of them have been supporting Republican Kevin Nicholson, but there is a new one up supporting State Senator Leah Vukmir. So this is clearly a target race with Tammy, a Democratic senator in a state that went to Donald Trump. This is going to be a pretty hot race, and it's getting more and more attention.
And for each of those candidates, there's been a key billionaire backing some of these efforts. Now we're seeing just yesterday, Democratic billionaire Tom Steyer was in Wisconsin to try to rally young voters. He says he's going to spend money here as well. I think not just on the Senate race, but on the governor's race as well. Lots of billionaires getting involved in politics all over the place.
Yes, they're throwing their money around. I think, like you said, it's slightly different. I mean, Tom Steyer also has a lot of money and wants to throw money into Wisconsin, into organizing and getting out the vote, and no doubt supporting Tammy and the other Democratic candidates. But what's a little bit different is that Dick Uihlein, who's supporting Kevin Nicholson, is basically given money to super PACs that seem to be devoted to helping Kevin Nicholson. And then Diane Hendricks, who's supporting State Senator Vukmir, you know, again, it's sort of super PAC devoted to helping her. So that's where, so far, Tammy doesn't have the same support, but it's still very early. You know, one difference is Tammy doesn't have a general, sort of a primary opponent. So whereas the Republicans do. So maybe in the general election, we'll see more big money Democrats coming in to help her.
And then finally, John Bolton coming in as a national security advisor. And we've seen now three departures are related maybe to that. Tom Bossert, the president's advisor on Homeland Security, resigned this week. We just heard of another resignation earlier today and one over the weekend, all in national security, Homeland Security posts. A lot of turnover there with the new guy coming in.
This is John Bolton cleaning house. John Bolton, you know, he was Bush's UN ambassador, incredibly controversial figure, known as a sort of a hawk, sort of a warmonger. And he, you know, not everyone in the Trump administration and in the White House is on board with him. Some people are, but he wants to install his own team, his own national security team. So we will see some very, very different types of people going in the national security team at the White House now.
Amanda, do you remember a day once upon a time when there was such a thing as a slow news week?
I think I might have had it one or two days last week, and I was sort of hoping that this would be going for a while, but I can't believe it's only Wednesday this week.
Thanks a lot for joining us again. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Amanda Turkle is the Washington Bureau Chief at the Huffington Post. She joined us for a weekly look at the top news in national politics. What's the state of health insurance here in Wisconsin? You may have heard that the Trump administration made changes to the Affordable Care Act last year, and in a busy legislative session, Governor Scott Walker pushed for changes at the state level, too. What does it all end up meaning for you as a healthcare consumer? Donna Friedsam is the Health Policy Programs Director at the UW Population Health Institute. She also oversees Covering Wisconsin, a program that connects residents of the state with the right health insurance plans. Donna, welcome back to Central Time.
I'm pleased to be with you.
Well, the Affordable Care Act was not repealed at the federal level, but there were changes. What are some of the most significant things that have changed?
Well, possibly the most significant change has been the repeal of the so-called individual mandate, or the requirement that people have some kind of insurance coverage if they don't qualify for an exception. And that occurred most recently with the passage of the Republican tax bill in January.
You wrote a recent piece that's over at wiscontext.org. It seems like a lot of changes, big and small, have led to one thing, premiums going up for people getting coverage under the Affordable Care Act marketplace. What are we seeing and what's driving that?
So there's been several changes over the last year and a half that have led to the premium increases that we've seen both this year going into the 2018 calendar year coverage year and the 2017 coverage year. And these things are a result of various policy changes that occurred in that time frame since the 2016 election, really, as well as, frankly, just the uncertain policy environment. What business likes best is certainty, and it's very difficult to price a product if the insurance companies don't know what they're going to be facing with regard to the policies and with regard to the who's going to be enrolling in their products. So they need to price their products for the uncertainty that they're facing. However, what we saw in the last year and a half, in addition to the most recent repeal of the individual mandate, is the elimination of a reinsurance plan or expiration of a reinsurance plan that had existed within the Affordable Care Act, the elimination of payments for cost-sharing reductions for low-income people. So the insurance companies built those their requirement to provide those discounts. They built that those costs into the premiums instead. And a reduction in the amount of time people have to enroll in the plans during the open enrollment period, which tends to favor the people who are most motivated to get the coverage, which are older or health or less healthy people. Younger, healthier people tend then to delay and perhaps not show up for getting coverage. All of that leads to a higher risk pool and higher premiums.
Yeah, a lot of those things you just said mean those younger people don't end up participating in the marketplace, so older or less healthy people who are more expensive for the insurers end up, and that's part of, as I understand it, what that reinsurance program through the federal government was supposed to kind of hedge for insurance companies. Is that right?
That's right. So we did have a reinsurance program over the first few years of Obamacare, and then that expired, and Congress did debate reauthorizing the reinsurance program last year as one of the efforts to address the price increases that we were seeing, the premium increases. People may recall, though, hearing it was a very heated debate, and there was discussion about, oh, we don't need to bail out the insurance companies, and it was kind of cast as a bailout of the insurance companies, and so it didn't ultimately prevail. There was no reauthorization to fund a reinsurance program for the insurance companies. So then it devolved to the states trying to do that. And as you see, we're doing here in Wisconsin, put a reinsurance program in place, ironically using the Affordable Care Act funding to do that.
There are people who are kind of seeing a squeeze. We talked about that earlier this week while overall coverage numbers have come up. There are some people, because of their financial situation, because of the availability of health insurance, they're seeing premiums of $2,000-$3,000 a month. Can you talk about who is really not doing well under the current picture?
Right. So the people that are most affected by these premium increases are people who are on the individual market, so who don't get insurance through an employer or through a spouse's employer or a relative or through their parents or the like, who buy insurance on their own but don't qualify for the federal premium subsidies under the ACA or the ACA, otherwise known as Obamacare. So these are people who have incomes above four times the federal poverty level or 400% of the federal poverty level. So they make too much in income to qualify for the federal subsidies to purchase insurance, but they're fully exposed then to the premium increases as they exist. And so they then, when the premiums go up, they have no ability to handle the amount of increase that we're seeing. And so that's a substantial hit for that kind of middle-class group of people who are on their own in the insurance market.
Talking to Donna Friedsam with Covering Wisconsin and the UW Population Health Institute, looking at the latest national and state news on health coverage, what it means for us here in Wisconsin. Donna, you wrote in that piece at WisConText that a lot of attention here is on the marketplace under the Affordable Care Act. People who are getting coverage through employers, though, you say should be paying attention. These debates will ultimately affect them, too.
Absolutely. People think, oh, well, I don't get an Obamacare plan. That doesn't affect me. But actually, the Affordable Care Act had a number of provisions that touch on really everybody, whether you have employer-sponsored insurance or you buy your own insurance or you're in Medicaid or wherever you get your coverage. One of the things people are perhaps most familiar with is the provision that prohibits insurers from discriminating based on pre-existing conditions. So that's probably the most popular provision in Obamacare, where no longer can insurance companies deny people coverage based on whether they have an existing health condition, whereas previously people found themselves unable to get insurance coverage when they had that health condition. Or they may have been offered a product, an insurance product, but the price of that product was so high that it was simply unattainable for people. Now, under the Affordable Care Act, they can't be denied that coverage. And in addition, the pricing for that product needs to be within a range similar to pricing for everybody else. It's under kind of a, what we call a community rating system. So that if the Affordable Care Act were to go away, you do hear a lot of governors, including our governor, endorse the concept of retaining that protection for people with pre-existing conditions. But what's very important is that that provision doesn't stand alone. If it's not coupled as well with rating protections, then people will find themselves priced out of insurance. They may be able to get an offer of insurance, but there's no rules that protect them from having that offer be very, very expensive. So I like to say, look, I have the right to buy, for example, a yacht, and nobody is going to deny providing me an offer to buy a yacht, but I don't have the financial ability to buy that yacht.
I also wanted to bring up work requirements for Medicaid, Badger Care here in Wisconsin. What has changed now in Wisconsin? How will it all work?
So the state Medicaid program has put in several requests to the federal government to change the rules of our Medicaid program. The reason they have to do that is because our Medicaid program operates, like in every state, as a federal-state partnership. The federal government pays in Wisconsin about 60% of the costs of service, and our state pays about 40% of the costs of service. And that varies, but that's the general rule. So in order to change the program, because it is that partnership, the state needs to get agreement from the federal government about some of the changes we want to make, and we do that through what's called a waiver. What Wisconsin has requested, a number of things, but one of the things is to have some work-related provisions, so to ask people who adults who are referred to as childless adults or adults without dependent children to engage in work or other work-related activities. And Wisconsin's request is different from several other states like Kentucky that have been approved, because Wisconsin doesn't say if you don't work, you're removed from the program. Rather, Wisconsin says, you know, we're going to put a 48-month limit on eligibility for coverage, but if you work or engage in these work-related activities, we will stop the clock on this 48-month limit. So it's something of a different structure than you see in these other states.
On a practical level, how many people would be affected by that? Will this ultimately lead to people losing coverage after that 48-month countdown ends?
It's somewhat unclear how many people will actually be affected by this. The state did put projections out about what kinds of changes we would see in enrollment, and they did put some projections showing some small declines in overall enrollment. But what we know is, on a national level, among adults who are not disabled but are enrolled in Medicaid, about 60% of them are already attached to employment. So this would presumably be affecting about the 40% of adults who are not attached to employment. If the Kaiser Family Foundation has surveyed that population, and within that group, most of them say that they're not currently employed because they're home taking care of somebody, or they're in school, or they have some kind of a disability that's keeping them from employment. If that is indeed the case, and those survey responses hold up as fact, most of those people would be exempt from the work requirement as it's structured in Wisconsin anyway, so they would not be affected. What I think is that more likely what we're going to see is the declines in enrollment, simply because people are confused about whether they still qualify for coverage, and they may not present themselves for coverage, or they may find it difficult to produce the kinds of verifications they need to retain their coverage. But I don't know how substantial it will be. That remains for an evaluation.
Donna, thanks a lot for being with us today.
Thank you.
That's Donna Friedsam. She oversees Covering Wisconsin, a group that connects Wisconsin residents with health insurance coverage. She's also the Health Policy Programs Director at the UW Population Health Institute. She's the author of a recent article. You can find it at wiscontext.org. It's called What's Next for the Health Insurance Landscape in Wisconsin. Every 2 years, thousands of Wisconsin high schoolers are surveyed about their lives, their drug and alcohol use, their emotional well-being, their sexual behaviors and physical health, among a lot of other things. It's called the Wisconsin Youth Risk Behavior Survey, and this year teens reported their lowest alcohol use since 1993, when that survey was first commissioned. But anxiety and suicidal thoughts among Wisconsin teens are on the rise. Kate McCoy is the evaluation consultant for the Youth Risk Behavior Survey at the Wisconsin Department of Public Instruction. Kate, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Before we dig into the results, Kate, can you tell us a little more about the Youth Risk Behavior Survey?
Absolutely. So this, as you said, is a survey of high school students that we in Wisconsin conduct every 2 years. And we're not the only state that does it. This is a survey that is conducted by almost every state, and every state has some version of it. And it asks about typical youth risk behaviors, alcohol and drug use, driving, sexual behavior, some questions on school safety, physical activity, health and nutrition, and mental health.
And this year, it looks like there's some good news and bad news. I assume that's often the case. I want to start with what looks like good news anyway, Kate. It looks like things like alcohol use, other drug use, and smoking dropped, you could maybe even say plummeted for teens over the last bunch of years. Is that right?
I think that's pretty accurate. We do see across all kinds of substances that we survey about some pretty steady and in some cases dramatic decreases. And like you said in your intro, in Wisconsin, we're pretty interested in alcohol abuse because we tend to be pretty high. And that's one of the places where we've seen a pretty major decline.
And when this survey first came in, the numbers I think were seen as alarming of how much alcohol kids were drinking and how early they were starting to drink. Is that right?
You mean when we first started
back in 93, yeah.
5 years ago? Well, yes. I mean, I think anytime people start asking questions about things like alcohol and teen sexual behavior, any result can be alarming, right? But we were at, very high numbers. So when we were looking at students who are currently drinking alcohol, we've been over, 50% before, and now we're at 30% of students who are currently drinking alcohol. Students who ever drank, we were at 78%, and now we're down to 64%. So these are pretty notable decreases.
And can you talk about the decline in smoking? What kind of numbers are we seeing there?
Yeah, I think that's one of the most dramatic declines. And people who work with youth really have noticed this, that smoking cigarettes is not there like it used to be. So that has gone down from the number of kids who ever tried cigarettes used to be around 64%. Now we're at 24%. And whereas almost a third of kids used to smoke currently, now we're in single digits, 7.8%, and only about 1.5% of kids smoke cigarettes on a daily basis. So it is really... that is not a big issue for our students currently.
One question I believe you asked for the first time this year about vaping. What did we find out?
We did. So we do see vaping at higher rates than cigarette use. 11.6% of kids do vape, so it's something we're going to keep in the survey. We want to get some trends on that. But again, it's much lower than cigarette use traditionally was, so we'll just keep an eye on it.
Talking to Kate McCoy, evaluation consultant for the Youth Risk Behavior Survey at the Wisconsin Department of Public Instruction, looking at this year's results. Kate, let's turn to what looks like some of the bad news here, an increase in things like anxiety and even suicidal thoughts and even suicidal planning among teenagers. What did you see?
That's right. So this was really one of the things that struck me when I first started looking at this data, because as we just discussed, so many things that you think of as warning signs are trending in a positive direction. So we have less drug and alcohol abuse. We have some indicators of better physical health behaviors, kids making better choices in terms of a lot of risk behaviors. They're acting safer, but they're feeling worse. And so when I first started looking at these numbers, I started looking around at other existing research to see, is this possible and what might be going on here? And indeed, other people have found this in other cases throughout the country and using other types of surveys as well. So even though you would think with drug and alcohol use on the decline, kids would be feeling better, we're actually seeing increasing rates of depression and suicidal ideation and high rates of anxiety.
Can you talk about the numbers? What proportion of kids are feeling these things?
Yeah, so for suicidal ideation, they're not through the roof, but we're seeing it start to edge up. So about 16% of kids are considering suicide. And 7.8% have attempted, and we also ask about planning. It's unevenly distributed, so some kids are at much higher risk than others. So students who are sexual minority, LGBT status, have disabilities or a chronic health condition, students of color, and females, actually, and students with low grades are at much higher risks of things like suicide ideation. We also asked about anxiety for the first time because we hear from schools that that is a major issue that they're confronting. And we found about 50% of girls and 30% of boys have experienced debilitating anxiety in the past year.
On a related note, you asked, I thought this was really interesting, about protective factors, positive influences, including having people to talk to about whatever these issues are, anxiety and everything else. What kind of things do you hear?
Yeah, so we haven't seen that those things have gone down a lot, which is interesting. But you do see that the kids who are most at risk have lower rates of saying that they have someone they can turn to. So the kids who have attempted suicide or are considering attempting suicide, they're more likely to say they have no one that they can turn to. Other behaviors that are disturbing, like we ask kids about carrying a weapon at school. When we look again at what else we can see about those kids who are maybe displaying some aggression, they're also less likely to say that they feel a sense of belonging at school or have a teacher that they can talk to.
Now, you do this report for the Department of Public Instruction. I assume you don't just look at the numbers, say, huh, and then put it in a file folder. What ultimately is done with this information, maybe at schools around the state?
Yeah, not at all. Our intention is to use this for the benefit of Wisconsin schools, Wisconsin students, and the entire state. So we're working very hard on disseminating the information. We have a lot of grants that are focused on things like mental health and suicide prevention. And so we're getting this information into the hands of those schools. We're using it to make the case for more of this kind of interventions, and it really helps to shape our direction. So, you know, maybe we don't need so much tobacco cessation, but we need a lot more in the mental health arena.
Well, and do you look back at those earlier surveys? Are you able to say, okay, we raised the red flag with those earlier results on high levels of smoking, say, and alcohol, and we took that information, made changes, and seen a lot of success in bringing those rates down?
Yeah, I think that's always one of the things that people look at and say, you know, was this about some of the interventions that we had, and to what extent were those interventions helpful? And I think, you know, some of the credit is due to some of those programs that have been in place for a long time. I think one thing we haven't yet discussed that is in the research is there's other things happening as well in society that are changing the nature of the types of risks that young people take. And so some of it is these wonderful programs we've had in place, and we should take responsibility and credit for that. And some of it is cell phones, and that students are staying home more. Instead of going out and taking risks by getting drunk on the weekends, they're staying home. And, you know, the risks are that they're getting bullied on their phones or getting anxious in that way.
What information, looking at the numbers here just briefly as we wrap up, what do you look at and say, I want to know more about that now?
Yeah, I'm very interested. We have just a couple of questions asking about what else kids have experienced who are in high-risk groups. In terms of trauma, that they might have experienced violence outside of school or in school. And the little bit of information that we have from this survey says that those students are particularly high risk. We know from other research outside of schools that those kinds of experiences, abuse, neglect, any kind of parental loss, those things really are what's behind the kids who are at highest risk oftentimes in these surveys. So we want to dig into some of that a little more.
Kate, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's Kate McCoy. She joined us to talk about the results of the 2017 Youth Risk Behavior Survey. Found drops in drug and alcohol use among Wisconsin teens, an increase in things like anxiety and depression. Kate's the evaluation consultant for the Youth Risk Behavior Survey. There's been a big, big change behind the scenes here at Central Time, and I'm guessing you haven't noticed it and you wouldn't notice it if I didn't tell you about it. So I'm going to tell you about it now. The big change is I'm standing. All right, they had to do some work here in the studio, and they said, okay, well, we can make some changes. And I've thought for years, I have a standing desk here at work after thinking about it for like 5 years. And I've thought for years, what would it be like to stand up and host the show? but I didn't want to commit to it with something that's like, okay, build that standing thing. Oh, I don't like it, and I'm stuck with it. So now they have this thing where the microphone goes up and down, and the little thing that holds my tablet here goes up and down, so I can stand and host the show. And I think Kate was doing it this morning. We were talking earlier. It's awesome. I love standing up and talking. I think I talk better. I don't know. But you may sometimes catch me feeling like sounding a little distracted. And I think sometimes over the last couple of days, there's been like, you know, whatever issue I'm talking about, I'm focused on that. I'm focused on what the guest is saying. But there's a part of my brain that's just kind of singing, I'm hosting and standing. I'm hosting and standing. But I'll get used to that. So I hope you noticed that, I don't know, I sound better or something. I feel more awake. That's for sure. Sitting down too long makes me sleepy. So, all right, standing Central Time. That's what's going on. Stand in the place where you were. Now face west. Think about the place where you live. Wonder why you haven't before. If you are confused, check with the sun.